With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Newt's World, since Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, Yaroslav Trofimov has spent months at the heart of the conflict, very often on its front lines. In his new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence, he traces the war's decisive moments to show how Ukraine and its allies have turned the tide against Russia, one of the world's great military powers, in a modern-day battle of David and Goliath. Putin had intended to conquer and annex Ukraine with a vicious blitzkrieg, redrawing the map of Europe in a few short weeks with seismic geopolitical consequences. But in the face of this existential threat, the Ukrainian people fought back, turning what looked like certain defeat into a great moral victory, even as the territorial battle continues to this day. For Trofimov, this war is deeply personal. He grew up in Kyiv, and his family has lived there for generations. Here to talk about his new book, I'm really pleased to welcome my guest, Yaroslav Trofimov. He is the chief foreign affairs correspondent of the Wall Street Journal, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting for two consecutive years. Yaroslav, welcome, and thank you for joining me on Newt's World.
Great to be on the show. Thank you.
You were born in Ukraine and came back to write about the Russian invasion in 2022. What was Ukraine like when you were growing up?
Well, you know, back then it was the Soviet Union. There was no such thing as an independent Ukraine. The current blue and yellow flag of Ukraine was outlawed. You would go to prison for even drawing it on a piece of paper. You know, the language of instruction, Moscow's was Russian. And, you know, the Soviet Union was pursuing a very efficient policy of Russification. The reason why half the people in Ukraine speak Russian today is because of that policy, because their parents or grandparents used to speak Ukrainian.
Was it a happy place? Was it a place you wanted to leave? Or what was your feeling?
Well, you know, it was a place that I left. I left it in 1990, before the Soviet Union collapsed. And the difference between the Ukraine today and Ukraine then is staggering, because an entire new society was born in those 30 plus years. And the generations that have come into being in a free, independent Ukraine are hugely different from the parents and grandparents, because they don't have that fear that was built into the Soviet system. They have the creativity, which they have shown in this war. And they have this desire, the really strong desire to remain free. If you look at the history of independent Ukraine, out of the six presidents it has had, only one was reelected. And twice there were uprisings when there was an attempt to rig the vote or to basically create a more authoritarian system.
Ukraine has been wrestling with, and steadily, I think, becoming a freer society and a more Western society, which may be part of the threat that Putin felt, that if Ukraine was really successful, that the signal that would send to Russians who were living in a place that was not successful would, in fact, have endangered his whole regime. Because you're so knowledgeable, what do you want every American to know about Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, thank you so much. I think the invasion of Ukraine was the first step in Putin's plan for a much greater rebuilding, first the Soviet Empire, and then rebuilding the influence that the Soviet Union used to have in half of Europe. And the, you know, Putin made it clear when he proposed ahead of the invasion, as his peace offering, the rolling back of NATO, essentially. So the withdrawal of all the American and other Western forces from NATO countries in what used to be the former Warsaw Pact. He clearly sees Ukraine as part of Russia. He has written this essay 6 months before the war, very long historical essay that is called On the Historical Unity of the Russian and Ukrainian Peoples. And if he had been able to get away with his initial plan of conquering and subordinating Ukraine, I mean, it would be having a war in another European country now, probably.
My sense was that if he could have won pretty decisively, that Poland and Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania would all have been under threat. But I'm curious because, you know, the American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said in public, and I think in a Senate hearing, that he thought that the Russians would get to Kyiv in 3 days. And my hunch is that that's what Putin's generals were telling him. Wasn't, in that sense, the ability of Ukraine to slow down and stop the Russian offensive sort of a remarkable shock to everybody?
I think Ukraine was and remains today an extremely misunderstood country, misunderstood by and misappreciated, underappreciated by the Russians and by the West until recently. And that comes from this lack of understanding just how much it has changed in this 3 decades of independence. You know, the Ukraine that was around in 2022 is not the Ukraine that people used to know in the 90s, the corrupt, hopeless place that was just finding its way as a nation. There was a sense of purpose. There was a pride. There was an experience of fighting the Russians because, let's not forget it, the war began in 2014, not in 2022. 14,000 people died in the war in Donbass in 2014. At the time, the West didn't help Ukraine. The West just stood by. President Obama famously said, there is nothing the U.S. can do to stop the Russians from controlling Ukraine. Yes, Putin believed that the Ukrainians will not fight, that they will surrender en masse, and in a matter of days, Kyiv will be taken over. And so did the West. You know, the U.S. government closed the embassy in Kyiv, pulled out the diplomats, and basically gave Ukraine a little bit of weapons for an insurgency, kind of like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, you know. A few boxes of javelins, some stingers, and good luck. So the expectation was that Ukraine as a functioning state would cease to exist within a week or two.
As I remember at the time that the Obama administration sort of had an attitude of, we'll send you meals ready to eat, and we'll send you sleeping bags, but we won't send you any lethal weapons. One of the major changes occurred. Trump authorized javelins, which, you know, are very effective tank killers. And that part of what hit the Russians was they, in fact, were really losing equipment and losing vehicles. And because of a very intelligent use of drones and of GPS, Ukrainians' forces in that opening blitzkrieg were able to just chop the columns up, hit the front and the back, leaving everything in between isolated. And it was an astonishing campaign in the initial surge. And I think the Russian logistics system was so bad that they just kind of fell apart.
Right. I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the javelins. Ukraine only had 90 javelins when the war began, 9-0, against, you know, thousands and thousands of Russian tanks and armored vehicles. The British were more courageous, and they supplied about 2,000 Enlaw anti-tank missiles, which I did see with my own eyes being deployed in the battlefield. I was in Ukraine since January, and I was in Kyiv when the war began. But really, the initial fight, so repelling the initial Russian attempt to take Kyiv, was mostly carried out using old-school Soviet vintage weapons, artillery, and anti-air defenses that Ukraine managed to preserve, and tanks. So it was really the old Ukrainian army using its vintage ammunition and vintage resources that repelled the initial Russian drive. And only after that did the U.S. and allies start supplying American artillery, multiple launch rocket systems, and everything else that came after that, including the F-16s that are now in the pipeline.
To what extent do you think the situation really dramatically changed because the Russian system just broke down? And to what extent was it this sort of methodical organization of the Ukrainian people?
I think it's both. I think on one hand, the Russians clearly weren't prepared for a fight. And I remember talking to people around Zelensky before the war began. And, you know, the CIA director had just flown to Kiev to warn them in great detail about the coming invasion. And they were really disbelieving because they were looking at the number of soldiers on Ukraine's borders. And it was fewer than 200,000 troops. And they were shaking their heads and saying, how are they going to invade the largest country in Europe by landmass other than Russia with such a small army? And they were correct in retrospect, because Putin's entire war plan was premised on the idea that Ukraine will just collapse and will not fight. And, you know, the troops coming to Kiev were carrying parade uniforms with them. And the commander of Ukrainian forces, General Zaluzhny, really decided to trade territory for preservation of forces for time. So instead of fighting, you know, for every village on the border, he pulled back the forces and then he attacked the Russian supply lines that were overstretched and really made it impossible within a month for the Russian army besieging Kiev to continue the siege. And so they had to withdraw, suffering tremendous losses at the end of March. I think what also changed is that, you know, Putin had this idea that a big Soviet army would be fighting a small Soviet army, in which case the outcome would be preordained. But Ukraine, though it didn't receive lethal weapons, except for a few javelins, from the West in the 8 years since the conflict began, 2014, they did receive a lot of training. So there were British, Canadian, American instructors training Ukrainian officers in NATO doctrine in this giant camp called Yavoriv on the Polish border. And they trained them in the idea of mission command, which meant that commanders on lower levels had full authority to engage the enemy as long as it was within the objective set by the central staff. In a conflict where Russia was advancing from 11 different directions at the same time, this ability to delegate, this freedom that the Ukrainian commanders had, is what really saved Ukraine. And this sort of system is only possible in a country that is more or less democratic, and that is where the army functions on trust, as opposed to the Russian army, which really is based on fear of superiors, in which the bad news don't get reported up the chain of command for the fear of angering superiors, and therefore bad decisions keep being made.
And of course, that model was one which we had developed for a long period of time, which allows us to delegate authority down to sergeants and corporals that in some armies get stuck up at majors and lieutenant colonels. I'm curious, though, and you mentioned earlier correctly, the fighting in the Donbas. That actually was the same period as the occupation of Crimea. What is your sense about whether in the long run Crimea is returned to Ukraine or Crimea becomes Russian? And do you see that different than the fighting in the Donbas?
Well, I mean, the conflict in Donbas and Crimea was different at the inception because the Ukrainian army did not fight for Crimea. Putin took advantage of, you know, mayhem in Kiev, change of government, you know, president being ousted, and Russia, which had regular forces in Crimea, just seized it, and the Ukrainian soldiers did not resist. The Ukrainian didn't have much of an army either at the time. In Donbas, a few months later, the Ukrainian army tried to resist, but by then there was this influx of volunteer units, people just picking up arms to defend Ukraine, and they were much more successful in Donbas. And 1/3 of Donbas was in Russian hands until the full-scale invasion of 2022. In both areas, there's been great demographic change. In Donbas, most of the population has fled. Nobody wanted to live under the Russian occupation, so people fled to Ukraine, the rest of Ukraine, people fled to Europe, people fled to Russia, but, you know, there's nothing to do in Donetsk and Luhansk. It's run by gangsters. Every man, you know, from 18 to 60 pretty much has been conscripted 2 years ago and sent to die, and there is no economy. Crimea has seen an outflow of also, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million people. Crimean Tatars, Ukrainians, others who are loyal to Ukraine, and a huge influx of settlers from mainland Russia. Ukraine's goal remains to liberate Crimea one day. How realistic that is right now, you know, right now it's Russia that's on the offensive, and Ukraine's army is starved of ammunition and has to retreat because U.S. military aid has been cut off for several months now.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It strikes me that there's a real key message, though, in that while Ukraine has not tried to retake Crimea, they have had a brilliant maritime campaign in which they have shattered the Russian Black Sea Fleet in a way that nobody would have predicted back 2 years ago. I mean, isn't that one of the great Ukrainian success stories of this campaign?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it's also, I think, it's a model of deterrence that Ukraine is trying to do to replicate in the air domain now. Basically, what happened is that Ukraine demonstrated not just that it's able to take down several ships in the Russian Black Sea Fleet, including the flagship. We're talking about dozens of ships, and strike the headquarters, but also it demonstrated its ability to strike the port of Novorossiysk, which is not in Crimea, which is in the Northern Caucasus, which is Russia's most important port. It's not just the base for the fleet, but this is the most important port for Russian oil exports. And the moment Ukraine did show it can strike it, Russia really stopped its attempts to interfere with shipping from Odessa, Ukraine's main port. And so the blockade of Odessa collapsed, and now Odessa is shipping more goods out of Ukraine and into Ukraine than it was before the war. So Russia's attempt to strangle Ukraine economically was thwarted, and by creating a very credible threat to Russia's own economy. And I think that's what Ukraine is trying to do now by using drones to strike oil refineries and other strategic industries inside Russia, you know, hundreds of miles away. I mean, the latest strike was nearly 1,000 miles away. In this sort of tit-for-tat that Ukrainians hope will make Russians think twice about hitting Ukrainian infrastructure, which they've been doing with great frequency using North Korean ballistic missiles and Iranian-made drones, in addition to Russia's own weaponry.
One of the surprises of this war is how limited the Russian military-industrial complex was and how much they've had to buy from Iran and China and North Korea. I mean, I don't think anybody would have expected North Korea and Iran to become major suppliers of military capability. But it's clear that the internal Russian system is literally not capable of meeting the challenge that they now got.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think corruption was part of that. Both corruption in the military industries corruption in intelligence services, because allegedly all these Ukrainian officials and military commanders were on Russian payroll, and Putin was expecting them to switch sides on the day of the invasion, and they didn't, because probably a lot of that money was skimmed along the way, thankfully for Ukraine. And there have been a lot of mysterious deaths of Russian, you know, military industry, you know, CEOs and other senior officials since then, and detentions and corruption trials. I think Russia thought it is a much stronger power than it is because it showcased its might in Syria. And in Syria, it was very successful. But in Syria, it only deployed about 3,000 troops. And the rest of the world thought the rest of the Russian army is as good as those best formations, you know, and the best pilots and the best planes that they sent to Syria. But the rest of the Russian army was not like that. The rest of the Russian army was still stuck in the Soviet era.
Well, and of course, the classic Soviet era involved such a huge force that Putin can't replicate it. I mean, whatever he's trying to do, he's not going to get the level of power that Stalin had and the sheer mobilization that occurred in World War II.
Let's remember history. And when the Soviet Union invaded Finland at the outset of the Second World War, Finland had about 3.5 million people. Soviet Union sent 900,000 soldiers to Finland. Still failed to take Helsinki. Finland still kind of, you know, held them at bay, lost some territory, but they survived as an independent country. And that's why the Ukrainians, when they were watching the Russians send, you know, 200,000 men into Ukraine, a country of 40 million people, were scratching their heads and saying, you know, what are they thinking?
I haven't seen Putin able to generate the sheer combat power that Stalin did. I mean, when Stalin understood how good the Finns were and how hard they were going to be to beat, I mean, he just really poured an enormous amount of combat power into the Finnish border. You haven't seen anything like that scale from Putin.
Well, first of all, Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's a smaller country with an aging demographic. Not a lot of kids were born in the 1990s because of all the economic troubles there. So they not actually that many young men who are that available to fight. And a lot of them don't want to fight. So Putin, for political reasons, refused to mobilize until losing Kharkiv and Kherson in September 2022. And so by then, his professional army was pretty much destroyed. But when he did mobilize 300,000 soldiers, more than a million Russians fled the country. And that's the difference, because they couldn't flee under Stalin. But in the current Russia, they could just hop on a plane and fly to Dubai. The ticket to Dubai was $8,000 one way on the day he announced the mobilization in economy class.
I have to say, somebody was making a lot of money out of those airplane flights.
Well, certainly, yes. Yes. And then there is also the issue of gear. You know, what are you going to arm these troops with? You know, the Russian military industries are not able to produce what the Soviets are producing. You know, when the Ukrainians knock down the Russian AWACS planes, they're irreplaceable because Russia cannot make them. Those are Soviet legacy planes. Half of their stuff that's in them was made in Ukraine. And Ukraine had the main aircraft engine plant in the Soviet Union, in Zaporizhia. And the same goes for lots of other stuff. So right now, Ukraine destroys probably three times as many tanks and howitzers in a month than Russia is able to either build or repair for, you know, using salvaged parts and really old models. This mathematics of attrition actually doesn't work in Russia's favor, as long as Ukraine is able to draw on the industrial base of the West and on the money from the West.
It's very important that we communicate with our listeners how vital it is that the United States sustain its support and sustain the flow of ammunition and equipment. But I have to take a brief moment to ask you about one of the more startling things that has to, I think, have some impact on Putin's thinking. And that was the attack at the concert hall outside Moscow, where Islamic gunmen killed over 130 people. And there's a lot of argument about exactly who sent them and who. Different people are claiming different things. But I think this was the biggest Russian disaster since Beslan. To what extent does that kind of attack inside Russia shake the system or shake people's confidence in the system?
Well, it's really hard to measure because there's no longer any opinion polling in Russia. If you say the wrong thing to your pollster on the phone, you can get arrested. People have been. I think Putin really, in the depth of his soul, believes that Ukraine was somehow responsible for the attack on Crocus. Because if you don't believe that, then you have to admit that you've been fighting the wrong enemy. His entire worldview would shatter. And the image of Russia as he's building it, because, you know, during the Russian propaganda, Russia is now the leader of the global south. And the Muslim world is its ally. And it's fighting against colonial domination by the West of the rest of the world, you know, on behalf of the global majority. He gave a speech saying it's impossible for Muslims to attack Russia because we're such good friends with Muslims. I mean, obviously, lots of Muslim countries were also attacked by Islamic State. They didn't stop them from, you know, killing. Most of the victims of Islamic State were actually Muslims. If you look at what they've been doing in the, you know, in Iraq and Syria and other places in 2014 and 15, I think Putin lives in a delusionary world. I mean, and the reason why he invaded Ukraine is the biggest proof, because he really believed that Ukrainians are Russians and will not fight.
You know, when you talk about Ukraine in that context, it seems to me that there was the brief period right after World War I where there was a Ukrainian independence movement. Then there was the terrible period where Stalin deliberately starved Ukrainian farmers and millions died as a result of deliberate Soviet policy. And then right after World War II, you ended up, if I remember correctly, with a pretty significant resistance movement for 2 or 3 years. I mean, that really was making it challenging.
Yeah, I mean, the Ukrainian idea has been around for quite a long time. And the title of my book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, that's a line from the Ukrainian national anthem that was written in the 1860s in Kiev. And it goes, our enemies will vanish like dew at sunrise. Very optimistic and very non-bloody sort of expectation of the enemies just going away. And at the time, the Ukrainian language was banned and the Ukrainian books could not be printed. And the authors of this anthem were persecuted by the Russian authorities. Then after the First World War, it was indeed a Ukrainian People's Republic in Kiev, and then it was another Ukrainian Republic. The Bolsheviks and Lenin realized that the only way they could control Ukraine is by allowing this idea of Ukrainian nationhood and Ukrainian identity. And so there was the Soviet Union with the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. That in the 1920s, 1930s was really Ukrainian. There was a policy of Ukrainization. You know, all officials had to speak Ukrainian. A lot of the leaders of the Ukrainian independent state, including its president, Rushevsky, returned to Ukraine to be, Rushevsky was, you know, head of the academy of the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. And then Stalin in the 1930s destroyed all of that. There's a term in Ukraine, the executed renaissance, because much of the Ukrainian cultural and intellectual elite was just shot in the head in the prison camps in Karelia, in northern Russia. And then there was this terrible famine and lots of other bad things happened to Ukraine, which is the reason why Ukrainians are fighting today, because they know what happens when the Russians come and take over.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Part of what I think it's hard for most Americans to realize is that Kyiv was actually the center of Russian civilization up until the Mongols attack, and that the great wealth, the great education, the great churches were in Kyiv. And Moscow was actually a relatively small settlement in the middle of the forest, which is part of what protected it from the Mongols, plus it paid tribute. But it seems to me that there is a deep historic sense of Ukraine as an important center of civilization that makes it more difficult for them to bow to control from Moscow.
Well, both the president of Ukraine and the president of Russia are named after Grand Prince Volodymyr of Kyiv, Vladimir. When Vladimir ruled, Moscow did not exist. 100 years after he ruled, Moscow did not exist. 200 years after he ruled, Moscow did not exist. And to the Ukrainians, the Russians claiming the heritage, the roots in the Kyiv Rus, which was not Russia, but Rus, is misappropriation. I mean, what they say is that, you know, we had this state in Ukraine, in Kyiv. It was a great state. And then, you know, many centuries later, the princes in Moscow, which, who only rose to power because they were collecting taxes for the Mongols, this was the historical reason for the rise of the Moscow kingdom, decided to appropriate our history and declare themselves to be the heirs to the Rus. And that is really Russia's foundational myth, because if you strip away that past, then the Russian sense of identity really collapses, which is why the existence of Ukraine as an independent country, Kyiv being the capital of a different country, is really a threat to Russian identity. And which is why it's so hard, not just for Putin, but a great many Russians to accept the idea that Ukraine is a different country, the Kyiv Rus is a history of a different country, and Prince Volodymyr was the Prince of Kyiv, not the Prince of Moscow.
It seems to me that in that sense, the likelihood of Ukrainian nationalism caving and deciding to accept the Russians is very tiny. That there's a deep resistance and a deep sense of identity, not both because they want to be free, but also because they want to be Ukrainian.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting how the Ukrainian identity changed over the last half a century or century. And that's really the reason why Ukraine has been able to be so resilient and to resist. Because, you know, Ukrainian nationalism back in the, you know, 1930s, 1940s, like most other nationalisms in Europe, was pretty dark. It was very exclusive, anti-Semitic quite often. You know, there was a lot of Ukrainian collaboration with the Nazis, as there was, you know, in the Baltic states and many other countries in Europe, France, and obviously in Russia too. I mean, there was an entire Russian division, Nazi division. It all changed in the 70s and the 80s, when the Ukrainian dissidents were in the same camps in Siberia as the Jewish refuseniks, as the Baltic colleagues, as the Russians. And the idea was, when Ukraine was reborn as an independent state, it was the foundational idea, is that it's a very American idea. Sort of, everyone in this country is a Ukrainian, as long as you want to work for Ukraine, for the well-being of your fellow Ukrainians. And that's why Ukraine now could have a president who happens to be Jewish, the Minister of Defense, who happens to be Muslim, the head of the military, who happens to be born in Russia, General Sersky. And nobody cares about that, because it's not about blood anymore. It's not about language. It's not about what church you go to, or synagogue, or mosque. It's about serving Ukraine, which is, I think, very unique among European nationalisms. They're all about blood and soil.
Well, as you said, it's a little bit like the American model, that you get to be Ukrainian if you declare you are, and you get to be American if you declare you are. They're absorbent nationalisms rather than exclusive nationalisms. Before we get to the vital importance of getting the next round of aid, the one thing that most bothered me about Biden's response, which was dramatically better than Obama's, was they kept having this fear that if they sent modern equipment, that would trigger Putin to go nuclear. And in a sense, the Biden administration kept locking its own hands. My guess is if we had sent everything we've sent since then in the first 3 months, the effect would have been electric in changing the whole dynamic of the war. But we kept convincing ourselves that if we actually enabled Ukraine to win decisively, that Putin's balance point would be to go nuclear. What's your estimate of the danger of Putin actually using nuclear weapons?
I think the bluff has been called over time, and it turned out to be just bluff. You know, it was called by Ukrainians as well, because at some point when Ukraine was advancing in September 2022, Putin declared all his areas to be part of Russia and said, now this is Russia and we will use all our means to defend them, not go any further, you know, and we have nuclear weapons. The Ukrainians went further and took the city of Kherson, the city of Liman, and he didn't do anything. So I think this self-imposed self-deterrence, as it's called, basically, you know, was really, really unnecessary, and it really undermined the entire effort. And if we look, you know, people will say, okay, you know, the U.S. gave Ukraine a lot of stuff. And that's true. Tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars of weapons and equipment over time. But if you talk to Ukrainian commanders, they would tell you, okay, well, there's a fire and you need a bucket of water to extinguish the fire. And if you give us this bucket of water right away, we can extinguish it. But what we got from the U.S. was a lot of teacups over the course of 2 years. There was never this critical mass. And whenever a new system was introduced, it was introduced in limited numbers. And by the time numbers increased, the Russians already would find a way of counteracting it.
So, given that we are now where we are, how much damage has been done over the last 3 months by American political infighting and inability to pass aid to Ukraine in a timely way?
In Russia, if you look at the map has not changed dramatically. Russia took the city of Avdiivka, which is a city of about 30,000 people. It's the first city it did take since May last year, and lost a lot of people. Russian estimates are 16,000 people died for Avdiivka, 16,000 Russian soldiers. Ukraine also is sustaining very heavy losses. Every day of these delays is measured in, you know, hundreds of lives of Ukrainian soldiers either killed or injured. And we don't know whether Russia will be able at some point in the coming month to assemble its critical mass to punch through the Ukrainian front lines, and to get dramatically more ground. So the Europeans have stepped in, partially. The capacities are limited, but they're doing a lot more than they used to. But there are a lot of things that only the U.S. can provide, such as interceptors for the Patriots. And Russia is taking advantage of this disruption in supply, lobbing, you know, missiles into Ukrainian cities every day, causing casualties, destroying the Ukrainian power infrastructure, and destroying its military capacity.
Whatever you think about Ukraine per se, the idea of allowing Putin to win and as a result project power into Central Europe and almost certainly, I think, try to reabsorb the three Baltic states, this is a future that we cannot allow to happen, that Putin's victory would be a catastrophe for everything that the Western world has tried to achieve since the late 1930s.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just in Europe, I would say. China is watching very carefully what's happening in Ukraine. The people of Taiwan are watching very carefully. The people in Taiwan will have to make up their mind one day. Are we going to resist the Chinese or are we going to just yield and surrender? And if they see the U.S. walking away from Ukraine for no particular reason, you know, no Americans are dying. You know, the U.S. economy is not impacted by the war in Ukraine. Unlike the Europeans, you know, the Europeans had to make sacrifices. They had to get rid of their dependence on cheap Russian gas that fueled the German economy. The U.S. didn't have to do that. The U.S. didn't depend on Russians.
Hopefully in the next 2 or 3 weeks, this will be solved and the money will start to flow again. And I think there are a lot of people trying to make that happen, including Speaker Johnson, who is taking some real risks in his own conference. Would you talk a little bit about your Wall Street Journal colleague, Evan Gershkovich, who's been detained in Russia for a year now, and also the whole challenge of the fact that there are over 520 reporters locked up around the world? I mean, this focusing on locking up reporters strikes me as an enormous threat to the whole free world.
Well, you know, dictators are afraid of truth. They're afraid of information. They're afraid of people piercing the bubble of propaganda. And that is one of the reasons why Russian leader Putin has gone after Evan, because Evan was there writing stories that explain what's really happening in Russia. He was doing his job as a journalist, was doing a great job, and that did not please the regime there. And we have seen other authoritarian regimes clamping down the press, not necessarily by detaining journalists, but also by denying visas, expelling them. We've seen it in China. It's very hard to work in China as well. Any foreign journalist going to Russia is playing Russian roulette right now.
It's pretty sobering. And of course, our prayers are with Evan and his family, and we hope that we can get him released. Yaroslav, I want to thank you for joining me. Your new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence, is available now on Amazon and in bookstores everywhere. I encourage everyone who's concerned not just about Ukraine, but about the peace of the West and the survival of our values and the necessity of defeating Russia to pick up a copy. And you can follow Yaroslav's reporting with the Wall Street Journal at WSJ.com. But thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you to my guest, Yaroslav Trofimov. You can get a link to buy his new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence, on our show page at NewsWorld.com. NewsWorld is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying NewsWorld, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of NewsWorld can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is NewsWorld.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.